You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
This week's bits. The best news nuggets from Breakfast and The Wire from this week.
Atamarie, good morning, Kohanaros Tokuingua. Welcome to this week's bits. The election results have come out and now negotiations within coalitions are in place to who will be forming the new government. We still need to get results from all the special votes too, and still not much will be known until at least a couple of weeks. This week on The Wire, though, we looked into some of the issues following the election, such as the fact that Labour completely swept Māori out of government by taking all of the Māori electorates. This then sparked discussion about the need for Māori seats in government and the discussion around abolishing Māori seats entirely. 95BFM's Harry Willis spoke to Labour Deputy Leader Calvin Davis about this.
Was it a bit unexpected, the losses of the Māori Party? I mean, was it a bit of a shock?
No, not really. The writing was on the cards in the 2014 election when we won six of the seven Māori seats. Mm-hmm. The Māori voters have spoken and their decision needs to be respected. We had a strategy. Part of our strategy was to go off the list at the time. Everyone criticised Andrew Little, saying that Andrew Little had told us to go off the list. Well, that's not true. It was our decision. He wasn't particularly happy, but he texted me to say, well done, your strategy worked.
Absolutely. So yesterday you did hold the first Labour Māori caucus meeting. How did that shape up? Like, what are some of the priorities you're looking at here?
Well, really, our first meeting was just an acknowledgement of everyone and congratulations. Right. We're actually meeting on Monday to start moving forward and looking ahead as to, what are our priorities and where we need to go. So, meeting number one on Tuesday was really for about 20 minutes, and it was just covering the basics and making sure everyone was comfortable. They know that they can come to me and the other senior MPs such as Nanaia Mahuta if they need help, basically everyone's just trying to get their feet under their desks and come to grips with the job. The six new MPs had induction week, so that was sort of really their priority, is get through the induction and find out actually what are the expectations and the roles they need to play in the parliamentary side of things before we get into the party side of things.
Don Brash did make some comments this week on the Māori seats. He went head-to-head with Willie Jackson on the AM show. How do you respond to his statements that he said that the Māori seats have outlived their usefulness?
Well, look, the Māori seats were foisted upon Māori back in the 1860s as a way to control Māori voting, make sure Māori didn't have too much influence. We've become quite fond of the Māori seats, and they've grown to seven now, and now we have non-Māori again trying to control the way Māori vote. And how do I respond? I just respond by saying nothing, because I really don't care for his opinion. I was in a debate with Don Brash about a month ago, where I told the story that's been retold up here in the north a number of times, that the Treaty of Waitangi is like a bridge between two banks of a river. On one side of the river are Māori, on the other side were a Pākehā. And the question was, who's crossed over that bridge to the other side of the river the most? And it's been Māori. We've crossed over, we've learnt the language, we've learnt customs and everything. How many times have people from the other bank moved into the Māori world and know our language and customs and things like that?
Absolutely.
And I said, look, Don, we welcome you over onto our side. And would you like to come over to our side of the bank of the river, cross over the bridge? And he just went quiet. Now, until we have a free flow of New Zealanders crossing that bridge and living in each other's world and knowing each other's language and customs and the way we do things, Don Brash can just, stick his opinions as far as I'm concerned. When he can walk comfortably in my world, as I can in his world, well, then we could maybe sit down and have that conversation. But until then, don't even bother, Don, because what he's wanting is for us to assimilate into his world and to put our world behind us. I just totally refuse to do that.
95BFM's Joel Thomas then also spoke to Chloe Swarbrick, who officially is the freshly new Green MP, the youngest MP in government in the past 41 years, on youth voting and how youth are not adequately represented in government.
I think that the reason that younger people are perhaps less inclined to vote than their older kind of cohorts are because they are first and foremost really bogged down in the day-to-day of life. So life is expensive. You don't have stability of tenure. We know that we've got the lowest rates of home ownership since the 1950s. That means that more and more young people don't have security of tenure, so are very transient, which obviously then raises issues with regard to enrolment as well. But I also think another issue is the amount of young people who simply do not see politics as a way to bring about tangible change in their lives. Further to that as well, politics and politicians not being relevant, but on top of that too, perhaps the perception that politicians aren't trustworthy.
So do you think it's essentially basically like people being like, I've got so much going on in my life right now and I'm struggling to like even make rent, why should I care about this thing that seemingly has nothing to do with me?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's probably a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy as well, where at least we've seen traditionally that politicians do talk to the demographics and prioritise the demographics who are inclined to turn out and vote. I think we saw a change this election with that. I mean, obviously, I spent the past few months across university campuses holding potlucks in different flats around the country and gigs as well. We know that Jacinda as well spent a lot of time on campuses too. But I think that traditionally, politicians have spent time talking to people who they know will be inclined to vote. So there's a major issue there in politicians themselves not necessarily speaking to young people, so not making themselves relevant.
Do you think we can truly sort of have a representative parliament if young people aren't voting and their voices aren't represented then?
Yeah, for sure. That's one of the big problems that I perceive, and that's really the catalyst for why I got involved in politics in the first place. You know, representative democracy only represents the people who turn out and vote. And if we look at voter turnout statistics from 2014, which are the best ones to look at the moment because we've still obviously got around 400,000 votes to come through with the specials. But if you look at 2014 voter turnout statistics and compare the 18 to 24-year-old age bracket to the 70-plus-year-old age bracket, there's only 10,000 more people in the 70-plus-year-old age bracket, but 150,000 more of them vote. That obviously then skews accountability from politicians towards the direction of, you know, the people who have voted, so older kinds of voters. And I don't think it's any surprise, given that we end up with the super gold card, universal superannuation. And for some reason, you know, students are being saddled with massive student loans and, you know, living in rental accommodation at the moment is not an incredibly enticing proposition when you're paying an arm and a leg to live in a Māori flat. So that's kind of, that's the real catch-22, right, is life is really difficult at the moment, and one of the best ways to go about bringing about change is to implement systemic change. Right now, one of the best ways that we have to bring about systemic change is through participation in democracy, but because we're so bogged down in how hard everyday life is, we're not inclined to participate in democracy. So somewhere that feedback loop needs to be broken, and that's what I hope, at the very least, I can have a tiny impact on.
Do you think Parliament and New Zealand as a whole sort of discredits young people and the way that they experience life is like not...
I think it's quite funny because there's a lot of assumptions that age equals life experience. And I mean, the best way that I've come up with so far to try and respond to that and unpick that assumption is to say, you know, I know a lot of 40, 50, 60-year-olds who, you know, have spent a long time kind of doing the same thing. And I don't know if that necessarily means that they have more life experience per se if they've been in the same job for the past few decades. Meanwhile, obviously young people have an entirely different life experience, where so many of us have bounced from job to job to job, industry to industry to industry, you know, studied all kinds of different things, potentially travelled. But further, I really like the way that James Shaw, obviously leader of the Greens, framed my, I have the authority of my age. So my life experience is valid because it is a life experience which is not necessarily represented, well, it isn't represented in Parliament at the moment. But, you know, I have to try and walk that line where I'll be the first to admit and acknowledge that my life experience is not the same as all young people's life experience, which is, as soon as we start to think that, then we get into this really tokenistic place, which I think is not beneficial and doesn't help progress or evolve the conversation or the discourse at all. So young people are not homogenous, but I hope that I'm opening the door for more young people to say, yeah, okay, democracy belongs to me. If, you know, this person who's 23 years old and seems to not really know what they're doing but is kind of trying their best can do it, then I can too. So I think representation is important, but we also have to see, you know, meaningful policy and attempts to engage younger people.
Finally, another great story that came out of this week was Max Smith's story with A Woman Called Six, who launched a new K Road Chronicle, a street newspaper for the Karanga Happy Road homeless.
It's not just for the homeless, it's for the fringe, really. Like, we've got stories coming out on the volunteers that work at the NZPC, the Prostitutes Collective. Got stories about the K Road Business Association and their approach to homelessness. And, like, got stories about, like, the street cleaner who we see every day, but what's his story? What does he do, you know? And I think it kind of came out of a project that LifeWise did back in May, which I was involved with, called Rough Rag. And it was all community-based stories that, you know, the mainstream media are not too interested in covering, and that had a huge response. So ever since May, I've been on at LifeWise. When are we going to do another one? When are we going to do another one? And, yeah, I just get sick of these talk fests. So I decided, screw it, I'm just going to pick up the bat on my own. K Road Business Association, I wouldn't say it's sponsored by the K Road Business Association, but they were the first to come up with an offer of some funding. Other people have come out of the woodwork with funding. Stuff did that story last week. Southland Times have done a story. The support has been huge. And it, for me, it's a way of making a real difference to the fringe community. So it's not for profit. All profits will be returned to the community through direct action initiatives. I mean, nothing against the Auckland City Mission or LifeWise, but if I give them $1,000 or $2,000, whatever, I don't know what happens to that money. So I would much rather go out and buy, you know, $1,000 worth of nice coats. Or I was talking to Wilf at the Auckland City Mission, who are a supporter of this project, and he said, you know, we move people into houses and they might not have a toaster, so, you know, we'll go and buy toasters. We'll make a real difference. And it's loosely based on the big issue, which is done overseas, and the guys on the street will get a bundle of newspapers, so explicitly they get the help from the koha, whether it's 10 cents or $10, get a newspaper, and implicitly you get informed about the issues that affect the fringe community. You know, because a lot of times it's not the big things. It's, you know, where am I going to brush my teeth this morning?
Right.
Where am I going to have a shower? And all those little things that, you know, we just take for granted when we've got a home. So.
And it's going to be K Road focused, right?
It's K Road focused because that's manageable for me. I mean, at the moment, it's really just me and a few volunteers that are putting it together. But if I get the model right, there's no reason why we couldn't expand to Queen Street or Victoria Street down in Hamilton. I've already been approached by people in Wellington wanting me to help them set up a similar project. And I'm like, well, slow down a bit. Let's make sure this first one's a success. And if the model works right, I think it could be applied to different things as well, not just newspapers, but, you know, maybe those small commodities that we need on a regular basis. You know, there's no reason why the model couldn't be adapted. I mean, the big issue are doing coffee now over in England. So,
I think it's funny because we're talking about, you know, coming up with new funding models for the media to save, you know, us from the newspapers no longer making as much money. But here you are with a newspaper as kind of a new funding model for the homeless community, right?
Yeah, and it's an old school model, you know. Like, everyone's like, oh, am I going to be able to get this online? It's like, no. Why would I want to put the copy online? I want to direct people to the newspaper. Then down the track, we might do an online kind of behind the scenes sort of thing. But the actual content, it's good quality content. It's got journalistic integrity and value. And I've already been talking behind the scenes with some guys from Stuff about how we can work in with them as well. So there's huge support for it. And I think that, you know, there's a place for a tactile newspaper that you can pick up, you can put in your bag, you can read it on the bus. You don't have to download it.
So, and so when can we expect to see the first issue?
First issue comes out next Friday, Friday the 6th.
Yep.
We're aiming to do an issue every the first Friday of the month within the first year, and then hopefully within a year to 6 months we'll go fortnightly.
That was this week's Bits. To listen to the full interviews, visit 95bfm.com and check out the Bcasts.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.